Well, we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Ecclesiastes 3. This one is because the opening verse is in Ecclesiastes 3. This is probably, I wouldn't say probably, definitely the most well-known passage in Ecclesiastes. It's been the subject of a few songs. I forgot who it was, but somebody, pretty much the whole thing was somebody's songs back in the 60s. And then I know one phrase later on out of this was a Ray Stevens song in the 70s was the basis of it. But he starts off and he says, "There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. A time to search and a time to give up as lost. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear apart and a time to sew together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I have seen the task that God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end." Well, we'll stop at reading there for the moment. In this section, it starts off really with a thesis statement in verse 1 that, or the first, one that he says, there is an appointed time for everything. And there is time for every event under the sun. This word event, or if you have an NIV, it has activity, means to express emotional delight. It's referring to willful actions, decisions by people. There's an appointed time for everything. There is a time for every activity, every event, every delight, everything that people are involved in. But it's also, at some level, people making decisions. And then, having made this broad statement, he goes through an illustration to illustrate it. And there's 14 pairs, with this 14 opposites that are happen here. It's and these are these vast polar kind of things. So it's going from one one extreme, if you would, to the other extreme. And by doing this and both by the using the opposite poles in these comparisons, and by the 14 statements, that's a multiple of 7. It's thought both of those together is looking at this sense of totality. It's this is encompassing everything, and it we would probably miss the overall point if we were to look at each one of these and try to make just total sense out of each one, kind of as an independent saying. It's not that they don't make sense or have meaning. Obviously, they have to have meaning, or it wouldn't work. But it's not so much that each individual one has meaning. It's grouped together that they have meaning, because it's that whole span. In that sense, while they become this generalized description of the kinds of things that people experience. So you may not experience them. I may not experience them. We might even collectively as a group not experience them. But these are things that that one could observe in the world that people experience. And specifically Solomon, in his observations, this is how he saw things in the world. With these 14, when you look at them, it says, a time to give birth and a time to die. It's interesting, if you look at the very last one, it says a time for war and a time for peace. And it's been pointed out that these two, you know, beginning and end, are two things that people, by and large, don't have any control over. I mean, obviously, somebody has control over wars, or else wars wouldn't start. But in the sense of people, you don't, you know, generally people don't start wars. It's you know, it gets a little more specific to a person, a country, a, you know, a leader, something that happens. But these are generally, you know, so it starts with this kind of a broad sense. You don't really have a whole lot to do with when you're born. You don't have a lot to do when you die, in that general sense. And then the same thing with war and peace. But in between are just this, you know, real extremes. He says, verse 2, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. So, yeah, that natural sense of agriculture, that you go out and you plant your crops, you put your corn in the ground, and, you know, after it tassels out and the corn is ripe, you uproot it, you harvest it. We're in Ecclesiastes 3, verse 3, it's time. A time to kill and a time to heal. You know, these shouldn't be seen as endorsements. You know, like there's a time to kill as though it's appropriate to kill. But this is more the, you know, when you look at, if you just go back in a short history, you could say, well, we see that there's been these times, evidently, of war. There's been these times, you know, there's these times of healing. A time to tear down and a time to build up. Then it moves into something, you know, that's real general, for, you know, real universal in that sense. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. And so those are, you know, looking at the emotions that people experience, and that people experience these all the time, that there's something that people weep about, there's something that people laugh about, there's something that people mourn about, there's something, you know. And so these become almost parallel statements. Verse 5, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. This one, of all the ones here, is the one that people say they really don't know what it means. You know, I mean, you can find an opinion, but it's the one that's much harder to figure out. Because when you look at the other ones, there's a sense that you're always dealing with, well, is this looking literally or is it figuratively? I mean, there's obviously a literal meaning, but is it looking at something literal, or is it using that literal sense to speak of something more figuratively? But when you come to this one, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones, some thoughts on it is, one is, it's... If you have this rocky field, for it to be productive, you gather the stones out of it. So the throwing stones then become, if you got a neighbor you don't like, you throw stones in his field. So in that sense, it would, you know, it definitely be some kind of a revenge thing, but there's also this sense of productivity on your part. That's a possibility. Another one is this word for stones is used elsewhere in Scripture, just as gems. And so it may be in this sense of, you know, there's this sense of procuring, you know, wealth is in view here. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. A time to search and a time to give up as lost. You know, just that sense that you don't know where something is, and you look for it, and there's a time to say, I think it's lost. That's usually when you find it, if you're like me, but a time to tear apart and a time to sew together. You know, some of these could be, as I mentioned, could be broader, could be figurative, not necessarily that it has to be literal, such as a time to tear down and time to build up, or a time to plant and a time to uproot. You know, those are also, we use those figuratively sometimes with people moving. You know, well, they uprooted us, or, you know, we're going to uproot and move over here. So they could have different meanings. And same here, a time to tear apart, a time to sow. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. And sometimes love and hate in Scripture is not so much the absolutes of love and hate as we use it, but sometimes it's more in a sense of a preference. But everything else here are polar extremes, so I wouldn't think that's necessarily the case here. But having gone through all these, it's just basically saying these are all these experiences that are common to people. Everybody, you know, in that general sense, everybody experiences this is what life is. And his point then is, you know, kind of gives this significance is in light of the fact that everything has an appointed time, what's the significance of work? What's the significance of labor? Verse 9, he says, what profit is there to the worker from that which he toils? I mean, if God has, you know, established that there are these patterns, that these are the things that go on in life, and when you look at this, there becomes that sense of, well, I don't really have this control over it because these are the parameters that life is lived in, then what's the point? What's the profit of work? How am I going to get ahead? How am I going to be in control? And that becomes, you're not in control. In 10 and 11, it's more of looking at it and saying, well, the reason for all this is that God is sovereign. God's inscrutable. His plans are you know, what's there. And he does this in 10 and 11 through really making three observations. He observed that God made everything beautiful in its own time. Now, that's one of those statements that, remember when that Ray Stevens song was out, you know, ages ago, and you know, everything is beautiful. That I heard a guy saying, "Well, I'd, you know, like to have him here singing that song, and I'd, you know, be putting up slides of all the suffering in the world and so forth." Yeah, I mean, you know, you really can't take that statement and put it with violence and put it with abuse and say everything's beautiful in that regard. But isn't that what we say on the other hand when we say that you know, God is sovereign and that He makes, you know, all things work together for good? So it's in that broader perspective. It's not that evil is good. It's not that abuse is appropriate. It's not saying that that is beautiful, but it's this broader perspective that's there. He also, Solomon observes that God put eternity in people's heart. That there's something within inside people that they sense something beyond. Something beyond. And then Solomon observed that truly knowing the works of God is beyond man. We can know about God, but to truly comprehend God, to comprehend His plans, to have this sense of we know what's going to happen is beyond who we are. You know, people cannot discover the key to the world that unlocks, you know, the mystery of the world. You're not going to discover this key that unlocks the mystery to everything, and therefore you can predict and control the times and the prophets that are going to happen. I listened, you know, too much to a sports talk show when I'm in the pickup and traveling and, you know, back and forth. And but one thing's that every once in a while they have these handicappers on there that are selling their service. You know, if you'll give them $300, they'll tell you who's going to win, you know, the next five games or something like that. And you know, I always think, you know, if they're so good at that, then why wouldn't they just take all their money and gamble? Why would they fool around with the job, you know, selling these subscriptions? But nevertheless, they use this term that they have a lock. You know, if you'll call in, you know, we'll give you the lock for the week. You know, this is my lock on the week. Well, you know, if it was really a lock, they might share it with you, but I can guarantee you they would be betting everything they have. Because, I mean, they've already established they don't mind betting. Well, that's their service. So, I mean, there's no morality here about betting. That's they're already there. But there's that sense that, see, we want that. You know, we want some sense of control. We want some key that unlocks things that we know this is how it works, this is how it's going to be. And when you look at these verses, Solomon's making that observation. In verse 10, he says, I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in His time. He has also set eternity in their hearts, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. God's made things appropriate. God's made everything beautiful in that, to use that older phrase. He's put eternity in people's heart, but yet at the same time, He's made it where people do not fully comprehend it all. And nobody has that key. moves on and gives, based upon all this, I mean, at this point, you're really moving, in many ways, Ecclesiastes is kind of the same message over and over and over, these cycles that it goes through. But at this point, you see the pessimism again. Well, you're just here. All of these things are going to happen. They're outside your control, and there's nothing there. And it kind of goes back into that pessimism. But then he moves very quickly here to a recommendation, and it's enjoy life as God enables. And so it's a little different than what we might anticipate, but it's very much of what we saw at the end of chapter 2. Since man in his ignorance of God's plan cannot be sure of the appropriateness or the lasting significance of his labor, Solomon again recommends that in this present life that you enjoy it. So there's an ability that, pursue this ability to enjoy life, but it has to be from a gift from God. So when life is received as a gift from God, then there can be enjoyment. However, if you pursue as a goal enjoyment, then it becomes very elusive. And so in 12 and 13, he says, I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Think about that. There's nothing better than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Now, this is following, saying there are all these things that are going to occur in life, these different seasons, these different things that occur, and that God's in control, and He set eternity in your heart, but yet at the same time, you're never going to have a key that just unlocks all this mystery. And so you should enjoy life. Enjoy life that God has given you. Verse 13, moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor, it is a gift of God. So there is that sense that's always going on through these that, what profit is there in labor? What profit is there in work? Well, there is no profit in work in the sense of some ultimate concept of profit that one can earn something and it's years forever because you'll come to a point where you're going to die, that you don't have these absolute controls. But yet in this present life, having said all that, Solomon comes back and says, but you should enjoy life. But life can only be enjoyed in the sense that he's talking about it when you see it as a gift from God. He moves on with a purpose, and the purpose of all of this becomes that people may revere God. There might be that proper worship, that proper fear of God, that God's plans are eternal and immutable. 14 and 15, he says, I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear Him or revere Him or worship Him. And that word for fear, at times can mean to be afraid, and it's the context of how you're talking about being afraid or you're talking about reverence. And so here it'd be in that sense of reverence, revere, worship. That which is has already has been already, and that which will be has already been. For God seeks what has passed by. Once again, this poetic way of saying, God's in control. It's not necessarily saying, everything repeats on a cycle, but that God's in control. He's a sovereign God. And so when we look at all of this, we say we should revere Him. And that's, I already mentioned the Romans passage, so it really isn't that far away from what Paul says in Romans, that God's a sovereign God. When these things are going on, there's those that love God, those that fear God, that He works all these things together for good. So there's that. There has to be that sense of God. Though it moves on in an application that, there's a with all this, there's even this sense of a place for injustice in God's plans. And Verse 16 says, furthermore, I have seen under the sun, so here we're again talking about it from a horizontal perspective, that in the places of justice there is wickedness, and in the places of righteousness there is wickedness. I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every deed is there. I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity, all is meaningless, all is emptiness in that regard. All go to the same place, all come from dust, and all return to dust. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward, and the breath of beasts descends downward to the earth? So, from this kind of horizontal perspective, you know, there isn't any noticeable difference between the end results of people and animals. They're all dying, they're all buried. But having said that, he also is pointing that, you know, you have this injustice that goes on there. You have wicked people that prosper, and you have righteous people that don't do so well. But there's also an appointed time for God's judgment. And so he interweaves through here this sense that there is a God and God has a plan with this perspective of how you view life horizontally. And so when we only see life from a, you know, an earthly perspective, you come to this, you know, what's the difference? And so, you know, evolution makes perfect sense to people that reject God. It's just, you know, a way of advancing. It's a way, you know, there really isn't any difference between these things. And you start looking at all these values in life, and you know, there has to be connections. You know, if you go back and look at some people, you know, have made an observation between when prayer was taken out of schools, you know, the Supreme Court justice, which is an overstatement because prayer wasn't actually taken out of schools. It was prayer. Schools could not mandate how prayers were to be prayed. But nevertheless, the result, as people have continued to be involved, is pretty much taking prayer out of schools. Well, then you go through and you look at all these changes in society and things related with schools, and they show, you know, the pregnancy rates goes up outside of marriage and, you know, abortion. You have all these things that are going on. Well, I seriously doubt that it was a cause-effect relationship there. I think more likely what we see there is that there was something in society that the Supreme Court, their decision reflected something that was going on with us in society, and we're moving in that direction. But with that kind of movement, then you come along with abortion, and you start having these decisions, and so obviously, you know, you have to change your terminology. You know, I mean, being anti-abortion and being pro-abortion, neither one of those work well in a political climate, so you become pro-life or pro-choice. So, you know, we change our terms to fit our causes. But then you start finding, you know, along these times that they're sort of becoming this random violence. And that in gangs, to be a member of a gang, you had to go out and kill somebody. You just got to, you know, go shoot somebody. And you say, well, how could people go shoot somebody? Well, we've already said that life has no meaning. And, it, you know, it becomes these natural extension of things that really is what Solomon's saying here. When you look at life from horizontal, they're just people and they're animals, and when they die, they all go to the grave. But before that, he's saying, but there will be a judgment. There will be a judgment. And that's the different perspective if there's a God. So since people are mortal, Solomon recommends that a person enjoy both his work and the fruit of his work. This is even more important to do since man on earth cannot know what the future holds, including you know, life after death in that, you know, absolute sense. But though, having said that, he's also seen it from a perspective of God, that God gives life. Now, we have, you know, we're bringing our theology to it from a different perspective, from other revelation and clear revelation, so it makes it a little hard. One writer says, we are to live life not in the hope of gaining some advantage over the rest of creation with which we share dust and breath, but simply for its own sake, finding joy in it and receiving that joy as itself the reward that living brings. When the dust settles and we arrive out of breath at the end of the journey, will be all that remains. There is that sense that at that point when one dies, that's not the end of your existence, but it is the end of this life and the end of whatever you're going to contribute or gain from this life. And so there becomes that question, well, then how are you going to approach this life? You know, in that sense of frustration that you're always looking for the key that gives you, you know, the control over everything, or to see it as a gift from God that can be enjoyed. Well, any thoughts or comments or insights? You know, and there, you know, you think about that. I don't know. I mean, I don't think, you know, we should come away from that with the idea that you don't influence your surroundings. But at the same time, this idea that, you know, like World War One, you know, well, okay, where things were supposed to get better, so we'll have this, now that we got this war, we'll never have another one. You know, we fall into these things that these things will never happen again. And, nobody, and I mentioned this last time, you know, nobody was trying to put anybody in a course of being in Iraq for 7 years. But yet, if you go back 10 years ago and to say, would we ever be in a situation like that? I think people kind of universally said, no. You know, we will never be in that kind of situation again. We will not put ourselves in that situation. Now, it's not like somebody set out to put us in that situation, but there is that sense that these things go on. You know, there's, you know, it seems to be the plight of man, in other words, you know. And there is that part, you know, that part we should be involved to try to make life and the world and whatever better in that regard. But at the same time, you know, there should be this sense of enjoying life as a gift from God, as opposed to being you know, just totally frustrated. I think I've mentioned before in the when would it have been the I guess mid-90s, early 90s, that there was quite a bit about the, you know, you kind of get into, you know, hear a lot of the terminology more about that time, the cultural wars that were going on. And, you know, that term was within evangelical circles anyway, it was being used as cultural wars. And, you know, and getting involved, and there's always these parameters that seem to be put out there, you know, if this benchmark isn't met, you know, if this president isn't elected, if this Supreme Court, you know, if we don't get this done or this done, then this is going to be what's going to happen. You know, it's going to be this decline of the nation. And again, I'm not saying we shouldn't be involved, but when we start putting these parameters out there as though we're in control, you know, what I started seeing with a lot of Christians, you know, that were really reading and listening to these people was all this depression. It was just this tremendous depression because the whole United States is collapsing. Now, everything is collapsing. Everything is gloom and doom. And you have to wonder, well, where's it, Where's Ecclesiastes in there? Where's Solomon's like, are we going to see life as a gift from God? Not to say that we just stick our head in the sand and ignore everything, but at the same time, how do we just change so quickly? I remember listening to the radio the morning after the election when Clinton was elected the first time. And you would have thought that God died. You know, listening to Christian radio, that was the way everybody was reacting. It just, something went wrong. Somehow God slipped up. He wasn't paying attention. And it's just this, and you start going, so we really bought into the idea that Bush being elected again and getting another Supreme Court justice, that was the Messiah. And you just kind of see how we do that kind of stuff. So, kind of interesting. Any other thoughts or questions? What do we have? Prayer requests.